Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2017. Lecture 20, delivered on November 2, 2017. The title of this lecture is Measuring Return and Risk.
Today, Measuring Return and Risk. Before I do that, I just want to make a quick point. I transferred your scores, your quiz scores, in-class quiz scores, over into my finance lab. Now, when I'm keying in 1,600 scores, that's 200 students in two classes for four quizzes, I'm going to make some mistakes. Just say, check ReggieNet, this quiz is not in ReggieNet, I got a better score than what you put in the My Finance Lab. Don't get mad. I had a couple of students, are you trying to cheat me? No, I was bleary-eyed. And why did I have to key in those scores manually? Because a few people decided not to put their names in like they are in ReggieNet when they did their Pearson My Finance Lab registration. You'll also have some information at the end of class today for one of those quizzes over the weekend. So keep in touch with me during this lecture. Again, today, measuring risk and return. And this lecture is going to have a practical side to it because I'm going to show you some Excel tricks, or they're actually not tricks. They're standards that are going to make you much more sophisticated in using Excel. I see on resumes all the time people say under their skills and all that, well, I can do Excel. Well, yes, we can all go to the bathroom too. That's not enough. When you get out there in the corporate real world, the Excel sheets you're going to see just blow you away. Just being able to write a formula in Excel isn't enough. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a little bit of an introduction to some of the more sophisticated things that you can do with Excel. It's really a lot easier to do this kind of stuff that I'm going to do here when you're using Excel. And also, it's going to make it easier for you to do some projects in your other classes, too, where you have to do things like make charts and use data. So stay tuned for that. But the first thing is measuring risk and return. First of all, returns. Now, obviously, we can measure the return on a stock as P1 minus P0 over P0, N minus begin over begin. That's the classic way, total return. But it's not quite enough because if somewhere along the way there were a dividend paid, that becomes part of your return. So we can put a little X through this and sophisticate it. P1 plus dividend, and I'll put a 1 here. This is a dividend that would occur during your holding period, minus what you paid for the stock over the price originally. That would be your total return. But again, as I've shown you before, to annualize it, you would have to do so. Take this total return annualized. You would take the total return, and obviously there would be more than one dividend in there. If you had it for 3 or 4 years, you'd have a collection of dividends you'd have to put in there too. You take your total return, well, let me do it this way. 1 plus your total return to the 1 over the number of years minus 1. That thing that I've shown you several times in the classroom before. And that would give you your total return on the security.
Really?
Okay, now, taking this a step further now, getting away from that to something a little bit more obvious right off the bat, is if we're working at annualized returns, we've got annualized returns on the components of a portfolio, then we could then say, okay, the over a period of years on our portfolio, what we could do is annualize returns and then add them up. And so we could use as one measure of return, we could use the average, which would, of course, just be 1 over n times the sum of the years of the annualized return. In other words, you just add up year by year and then divide by the number of years, and that gives you your average return on your portfolio, annualized return, in each year I. That's a fancy way of just saying add them up, divide by the number of years. Now, this is technically called the mean. That is the technical name in statistics for what we're doing here. However, there is something that you should also look at when you're doing these kinds of things. You should also look at the median. Now, the median is a little harder to write as a formula, but Excel can do it. Some of your calculators can do it. TIs can do it. Is the median half of the returns are above and half below this place. Now, if your data is normally distributed, like a bell curve, like that, the mean and the median will be the same number. Unfortunately, in reality, they oftentimes are not. There's something even worse I'm going to bring up in a minute, too. But I like to assume the bell curve for everything we do. It's the easiest one to work with. Your calculators can even do bell curve analysis and all that. But the problem is that if you've got a distribution that's not quite obvious enough. Let me do that again, a little more obvious. If you've got a distribution that is skewed one way or the other, oops. Then the mean and the median aren't going to be the same. So if you look at the average and the median together, it can give you an idea of what kind of skewing. So for example, in this one, if this were stock returns on your portfolio, you can see here that there is this long tail of higher returns, but then there is this big lump right here of low returns. And so in a case like this, half of the returns are, your mean and your median are not going to be the same. And the same is over here too. Now there's another problem, and you've got to keep this in mind because almost assuredly, well, some of you maybe not, but if you're in any kind of a profession or a business field where data is used for analytical purposes, you're going to assume a normal distribution almost every time. As a matter of fact, in finance, it has been historically the case that we assume a normal distribution. The problem is, let me draw you what would be a classic normal distribution. It's a pretty bell curve, a pretty bell curve. And so there is most of the probability of events lies in around the mean. In other words, in this one, if it's a true bell curve, I know that 67% of the time, the returns will be within one standard deviation of the mean. I know that 67% of the time. I also know that 95% of the time, the returns will be within two standard deviations of the mean. It becomes very unlikely. That's 95% there. And 99% of the time, they'll be within three standard deviations of the mean. And that is just because it is a normal distribution, and that's how normal distributions work. That's why we use them. They have very predictable mathematics. Unfortunately, stock returns don't do this. We assume they do for classes like this, and you will assume they do for a lot of things that we do in the real world, but the reality is that stock returns don't do this. Not quite. I don't know how far they went in your statistics classes, but there are many, many distributions. Normal is just one of literally an infinite number. On quite a few of them, we understand their properties. We know the ups and downs of them. We know where they usually do apply. For example, we know in education, chi-squares and F-distributions are more likely. That's also true in failure rates on products and things like that. But there's this one nasty distribution that looks very much like a normal distribution, except that its properties are kind of mean. Let me do this. That normal distribution here, here's its doppelganger. It's called a Cauchy. C-O-U-C-H-Y, a Cauchy distribution. A Cauchy. Now, this Cauchy, and get that in your notes, because I could, that's something that might be a good question, quick, easy question for the people who are here. But, okay, and I'll delete that part from the podcast. But, anyway, looky here. The Cauchy distribution is a bell like a normal, except that its tails are fat. Its tails are big. In other words, there is more probability in these tails than there is in the normal distribution. You see, once you get out past plus or minus two sigmas on a normal distribution, you're getting unlikely events. By three standard deviations, you're getting exceedingly rare events. But with this one that looks like a normal but isn't a normal, you have a much higher probability of events way away from the mean. Hence why, historically, we have not seen a lot of market crashes happen. Nor have we really seen a lot of the big upswings. But the worst part of it is that we see, because we have modeled on a normal distribution, we see crashes as extraordinarily, almost like once in a lifetime, maybe once in two generations or three generation events. And yet, they happen much more commonly than what a normal would say they should. And it's because returns are not normally distributed. They're distributed by this nasty-looking little faker called the Cauchy, where events like market crashes have an actually a larger probability of happening. Hence, crashes like 87, a crash like 2008, a crash like we'll have probably in the next 10 years. They have a higher probability of happening because stock returns look like this. Okay, enough of that for right now. And I snuck in something on you here. You see, the we can use two different ways. I wrote up here the average, which is what most people like to use for what your typical return is. Think of the average as the typical return. You add up your annualized returns over 20 years, and then you look at the average, and that tells you what's typical for a return. But also, I encourage you to look at the median as well, because the median says this is the place where half the events, half of the returns are below this and half of them are above it. The closer these two are to each other, the more likely you are to have a normal or a Cauchy distribution. The farther away they are from each other, interestingly enough, the more this your returns are skewing toward low or high, as I had drawn before. Okay, now taking that for what it's worth now, we need a measure of the spread. You see, now going back to just talking about a nice normal distribution and all that kind of stuff. You could have a normal distribution that is tightly wound around its average, around the mean. To say it in really fancy terms, the first moment of the distribution, or the second moment, is tightly wrapped on the first moment. But that's fancy stuff. Or you could have a distribution that is flatter, wider. So in other words, in this distribution, the probability of an event near the average is very high. In this one, the probability of an event near the average is not nearly as high. So in other words, the 67% plus or minus one standard deviation would be in this area on the tight, but it would be well like this, the standard deviation away from it. You could have events that are much more scattered. We see this in stock returns all the time. For example, you get a bunch of big companies and put them in a portfolio, the returns are going to stay fairly close year over year, as opposed to if you get a distribution of small cap companies, their returns on a small cap distribution, they're going to be wide. I mean, they're going to be all over the place. You're going to swear you're in a rodeo on a bucking bronco. One year you're way up here, one year you're way down there, back and forth. So we measure dispersion. And we've got a couple of different ways to do it. The first way, and this there are some problems in the chapter, and I'm going to show you a couple of things about this. The first way, a caution. We generally tend to use sigma, which is the standard deviation. This one is the square root of the variance of the returns on the stock or on the portfolio. Okay. The one problem with sigma is that it measures total risk. If you have a well-diversified portfolio, you've gotten rid of your diversifiable risk, so that's okay. But if you're looking at the standard deviation on a single stock or on just a little portfolio, you've probably got the standard deviation is capturing a lot of that non-systematic risk, that noise. So it's not going to be a particularly good measure of expected return that way. Take caution. Everything I'm saying here has pretty serious weight to it. So I'm going to say this one again, just so you understand, this is important. If you have a large portfolio, you have diversified away. You've gotten rid of a lot of that noise, that diversifiable risk, that non-systematic risk. And so the sigma on that, the variance of returns year over year, on that one would be pretty much capturing non-diversifiable risk. Volatility in that portfolio would boil down. It would have been boiled down to non-diversifiable risk. The risk for which you can expect a return. However, if you've got a small portfolio, you haven't shaken out, or a single stock, you haven't shaken out that noise. You haven't gotten rid of it by diversifying. So the sigma, which measures volatility, is going to carry a lot of noise in it, a lot of that non-systematic risk, a lot of that diversifiable risk that you don't expect a reward for, or you shouldn't. So there's a caution with using standard deviation. It's our classic measure of the spread of a distribution. But for financial investment purposes, it's much more useful. It tells us a lot more if we're talking about a portfolio that's diversified, or an ETF that's an index ETF, something like that, or a mutual fund that's well diversified. Okay, but now you did calculate standard deviations in your stats class. They are a pain in the backside if you got a lot of data. I mean, first of all, you have to get the mean, okay? You get the mean of the returns, and we'll call that R with a bar over it. In more advanced classes, oftentimes the bar above a parameter says this is the average or the mean. There used to be jokes, this is R bar, the pirate thing, okay? So you get that, and then you get the variance of the returns, which is 1 over the number of data points that you've got, the number of years of annualized returns, for example, times the sum from the first year to the last year of returns you've got of each of the individual annualized returns minus the mean of the annualized returns squared. That, I used to be stupid enough to put up data, like 10 years of data, annualized returns, and then do that thing. I don't. That's way too much like work. Your calculator can do it. One caution, if you're going to push data into a calculator like one of the business calculators or a TI, make sure that you are using the sigma. You're getting the sigma that is the n over n minus 1, because there's also a sigma which uses 1 over n. In other words, you don't divide by the number of data points by minus 1. It's dividing by the number of data points. Now, that one that you are dividing by the number of data points, that's called the population standard deviation. The one we use in classes like this and the other ones you'll use standard deviations, they use what's called the sample standard deviation, which is 1 over n minus 1. In other words, you divide the mess by n minus 1. Be careful if you're going to key these into a calculator, because it will offer you both the O divided by N and the divided by N minus 1. Now, in Excel, if you use the function STDEV, that will automatically do the N minus 1 version. Without further ado, I'm going to show you something here. These computers do have... Some of the computers here in the College of Business give some scripting errors when I do that. Don't freak out. I suspect it's some kind of an ad blocker or a pop-up blocker that doesn't understand what I'm doing here. But watch. I'm going to do something with you. Show you, first of all, the annualized returns on some different indexes over a period of years, like the S&P 500. There... through from 1975 clear to last to the end of last year are the annualized returns on the S&P 500 portfolio. In other words, if you bought the whole Standard & Poor's index, you pretty much have gotten rid of a lot of the risk, okay? But now the next thing I'm going to do here now, watch carefully if you can write down some notes or if you want to use your cell phone to take a photograph of this, how I'm pulling this off. It says, this is this kind of Excel that you would be expected to. If you say, I can do Excel on a resume, you should be able to do this. And this, I'm going to simplify the trick, but watch. Okay, I'm going to copy the website, Control-C, the URL. And this came from one stock one. And they've got a bunch of different returns. I'm going to show you a couple of different ones here, and I'm going to do the trick several times. But watch what I'm going to do. I'm going to go into Excel. I'm going to say data from the web. And no, I want this. Really? Come on. Okay, it's connecting. No. You see, this is why. It keeps trying to revert me back to there. See, scripting error, you suck, thank you. Okay. You'll see a little, and don't freak when it does that. It's just, I honestly, anyway, you're going to see a little arrow, a little yellow arrow, and it's going to say, do you want that there? That's a table, it looks like. Is that what you want? And you say, why, yes, it is. And I want you to import that stupid table. And where do you want me to start? Well, why don't you start up there where it's suggesting A1, which is a good steak sauce. Well, spank me. There's my whole vector of data all there at once in perfect condition. You see that trick? It's called a query. And you can query, one thing you can do is you can make a file of all this data, and you can query your file for stuff, an external file. Make sure you know where that file is and you can point to it. Or you can query the web. You can query all kinds of things and pull in huge amounts of, I mean, you can pull in massive amounts of data this way. And it's just a web query. This is especially useful. There's a database called FRED. It's run by the Federal Reserve. They've got over 5,000 data sets, everything from housing prices to income levels to stock prices to interest rates. And once you know what the URL is, in other words, the web address of what the data set you want is, you do this web query, and then you say, go there and get it. And it will pull it out for you and just put all that data into your Excel sheet for you to enjoy at your leisure. The same is true. The same is true, by the way. And this is one that I'll show you a little later. Remember how we were going to those Edgar filings, and we were downloading those big Excel spreadsheets of the SEC's 10, of the 10-Ks companies had filed? What you need to do is just save that Excel sheet and then query the file. Just open a nice simple Excel spreadsheet and then query that file you saved of the that you downloaded from Edgar. Okay, what do you want? Well, I want the income statement and I want the balance sheet. Leave everything else there. And it'll pull them into a brand new sheet for you without any problem whatsoever. This is one of those where you can say, yeah, I do know Excel, okay, kinds of things. Now, let's go through here. These are the ones you care about, are the percent gains and losses. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to back the size of this down a little bit so I can get all of it on one sheet. Seriously? I can't even see that. Okay. What I'm going to do here is I'm going to get back to home. Center and then left flush, and I'm going to say average. Then I'm going to do the same thing again, center, and then left flush. And I'm showing you Excel. When I'm doing this, the best way for people to learn things, a lot of people, is to see someone do them instead of just yakking. And then I'm also going to do the median of the returns. And then I'm going to do the standard deviation of the returns. And again, every time I merge and center the cells, and then I flush it to the left, and then I'm going to put standard, I can't even see this stupid thing, it's so small now. Well, that was a real, control X, control V. Oh, I see, no. Okay, kill the merge and center, and then reset it. Okay, kill the merge and center, I said. Now reset it. I did one cell too many. I did that on purpose, just so you can see how that happens. Okay, now, new trick. I'm going to do absolute referencing. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to say equals the average of the data here. Enter. And then I'm going to do something before I go any further. I should have done that before then. I'm going to put my cursor over on the first cell reference at the top, and I'm going to hit F4. And then at the bottom one, I'm going to hit F4. That means they're absolute references. So when I shift the formula, Excel thinks you want to move the cells when you copy a formula. But I don't want to. I want to look at the same thing. So I'm going to just grab the handle, copy it down one, and then all I have to do is edit average and make it median. And then I'm going to do it one more time here. And this time I'm going to say standard deviation. Say what? Did I do that on all of them?
Yeah.
Just irritate. See, I did that on purpose so you can see how easy it is to make a mistake. Oh, okay. Okay. In other words, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to take that, all that, and I'm going to absolute reference. And that gives me a chance to do that anyway. And then I'm going to do that. And I'm going to do an absolute reference. Wait. Okay, I got that one right. Now let me do this one. Okay. Will you stop bitching at me? What did I do? Okay. That did it. I can't see anything. Enough of that nonsense. Okay. There. Now, I want to do through 43 instead of 33. Trying to be fancy there. And then the standard deviation through 43, yes, through 43. What? What are you harping on me about? Oh, standard deviation, STDEV. You know what? Oh, apparently I shouldn't. No, I'm the one who doesn't use this keyboard. Did you see what happened there? Through E, okay, E2 through E43. E2 through E43. And what happened where I tried to delete, and it was that, it's that keyboard that does an E43, and then the dollar reference. There. Are you happy now? Just piss. Anyway. There. Now, one last thing I'm going to do here, just as a, and I brought this up before. Standard deviation is dependent upon the size, the scale of the numbers. So there's this popular one that we use so that we can compare different standard deviations. It's called the coefficient of variation. And all this one does is take, you say, equals your standard deviation divided by your average. Divided by average, wait, something is, that's not a percentage. That was what confused me. Coefficient variation is just a number. Okay, but anyway, there's that one. Now, I'm going to do something else. Keep an eye on your standard deviation here, okay? Yeah, I did, as a matter of fact. That's equals standard deviation divided by average. And then that... Let me scale that down so it's just two decimal places. Two. Well, shoot. Okay, now, what next thing I'm going to do once I get this one to do what I want, two. Oh, I see. I'm using the keypad and it will work. Good. Now, the next thing I want to do here is I'm going to do this same trick again. I'm going to open up a sheet. Now, keep this in mind. Your average return on the Standard & Poor's 500 was 9.9%. However, half of the returns were below almost 16%, and half were above almost 16%. So in this case, the 67% probability... Whoops, I didn't want that. The 67% probability would be, and let me center this, would be from the standard deviation, the average equals the average minus one standard deviation. I need to format these. These are terrible format cells. Percentage, two decimal places. Up to, the 67% would be up to the average equals the average plus one standard deviation. Format the cells down to two decimal places again. Okay, now let's tighten these up a little bit. So in other words, 67% of the time, the yearly return on the Standard & Poor's 500 was between about negative 6% and positive 25, almost 26%. That's a pretty wide, that's a large area, just with 67% probability. You do it at 97, at 95, Mergen Center, and do 95%. Oops, yep, I hit that key again. There it is. Okay, 95% would be from, let me format these before I do that, percentage, format the cells, percentage, two decimal places, okay, would be from the average equals the average minus two standard deviations. Really? I told it not to do that, and it did it anyway. Okay, up to the equals the average. And I'll stop doing this real quick here, but I do want to try to get to a point. And have you seen this? Average plus 2 times the standard deviation. Okay, now let me reformat those back down again. Format the cells, and it'll be 2. And now let me tighten these back up again one more time. Okay, so here's the thing. Look at this. The Standard & Poor's 500 index, if you had that portfolio, your average return across many years would be about 9.9%, which in a way tells you that if you were an investor and you wanted some reasonable belief that you could earn over a long period of time about 10% on your investments, Standard & Poor's is what you would look at. That doesn't mean every year or even for a cluster of years it's going to do that. But historically speaking, the Standard & Poor's 500 has achieved about a 10% portfolio return, which isn't shabby, because the Standard & Poor's 500, if you bought that spider, that would have a beta of 1. In other words, the market itself has a return over a long period of time, something around 10%. But that is buy and hold. That's not jumping from one thing to another, freaking out and selling when the market goes down, and then jumping back in after the market's gone up. If you look at these returns, and this is where the standard deviation talks to you more. Look at these returns. In some years, you've had staggeringly high returns. Look at that. In 1989, a 27% return. And look at this one. This is during the first term of Ronald Reagan. 83, 17.27%. That's a really good return. And of course, the president and his advisors were bragging, look what we've done to the stock market. Look how wonderful our policies are on cutting taxes. Then the next year, they were real quiet about what happened. You brag about your good years, and then you don't talk about them. Now, notice what happened. We had this string. Remember I was telling you about those very good years in the 1990s? See how it didn't start out so great, but man, look at that run of years. And then all hail broke loose, and then suddenly a whipsaw around, and then paltry returns, and then here is the crash. Oh, that was 2008. That would have been when you were about 9 years ago. You would have been about 12. And if you were in a family where they invested, you would have learned some very bad words about the investments. And then, of course, things got better. We began to pull out of it. And we had a kind of nasty return. Okay, now. That one is one. Now I'm going to do this one more time just so you can see this. Again, I'm going to pull up another sheet. Now remember, this one, and I'm going to call this one the S&P 500 sheet. Now I'm going to do one, and I think I'm going to do the NASDAQ. And you'll see the trick one more time. Data from the web. No, I don't want to do that. I want to go back here and find the URL of the NASDAQ. There it is. Okay? And I'm going to copy that so I can tell it where to go. Control C. Okay, you ready? Now, let's go back here. Whoops, I don't want to do that. Okay, data from the web. Now we're going to wait for it to calm down. Go. Oh, stop it. Stop it. There it is. The little yellow arrow, bang. Now I say import that. Do you want me to put it up there? Well, yes. Start it right there. Well, spank me. Look at that. How fast you can pull data. And I mean, you can do data sets. Literally, I do dailies, or I used to. I don't do it anymore. I did dailies for 25 years. Imagine 365 times 25 years. Entering that data, that was way too much like work. And now we can import the data as much as you want from all these different sites. I would recommend that you go to reputable sites. Sites that I might recommend or another professor might recommend, government sites. I would discourage you from going to sites that have .ru, okay? Those are Russian sites. I would encourage you not to go to sites that have .xyz or all those new extensions. .edu sites. .edu sites. There are some universities that maintain massive amounts of data just for research. The Federal Reserve does. There are some private institutions that also provide open data sources. But anyway, now let me try this one more time and do this right. Okay, I'm going to merge and center all the cells home. Merge and center. Flush left, merge and center, flush left, and then merge and center, flush left, and then, well, let's try that again, flush left, and then we're going to do the average, the median, oh, and the standard deviation, actually. Let me show you a trick here. If you don't want to keep typing, and if you've done it once, use what's called templating. See this cell right here? I'm going to say equals that cell right there. Equals. I've already done this once, so why would I do it again? And then equals. Whoa, I hit the wrong one there, sorry. Equals, going back over here, I want the median. Equals, I want this one. And this is what's called cross worksheet referencing. And then equals that. And now I can clean these up. That was a little mistake I made there. And then merge and center these. Now, let's see what happens. Remember that the NASDAQ is smaller companies. So what we would expect, first of all, average. Let's see if I can do this right this time. All the way down to there. And then I want to do the Fs. Equals the median. I'm just going to do it this way, because I can't trust the keyboard here, F4. Try that again. Equals the median. Open it. Pull that down. F4. And equals STDEV. Open parenthesis. And then go back up and get the data again. I'm not going to worry about the coefficient of variation. I want to get through this. Okay. Now. Format this cell because this standard deviation is a percentage too. Percentage, two decimal places, go. Okay, so now let me get this bigger so you can see it. First of all, notice, compared to the Standard & Poor's, the NASDAQ has an average historical return of 14.1. The NASDAQ has a historical return of 9.9%. Greater risk, greater expected return. The NASDAQ is smaller, riskier companies. Overall, there's some monsters in the NASDAQ. But you see that whole principle. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. There it is, just sitting there for you. Now, look at the standard deviations of the two. The NASDAQ, that's got to be wrong. So in other words, the spread of the NASDAQ, which would be a massive, well-diversified portfolio with a high beta because it's small, risky companies, standard deviation is 24.69% of the big, stable companies. Standard deviation, the spread is 15.86%. So you see right there again that difference between these two portfolios. The safer portfolio, the Standard & Poor's 500 with all the nice big huge companies in it, all diversified with each other in the portfolio, a little bit less than 10% return, standard deviation of 15.86%. NASDAQ, on the other hand, a greater return overall, 14.1 versus and a standard deviation that's much larger. Now, notice something else though. Look at the average for the NASDAQ compared to its median, 14.1 and 15.08. Do you see how they're close? Do you see how the NASDAQ has more of a symmetric bell? Look at the Standard & Poor's 500. 9.9, but the standard deviation is way above the median, is 12%. So they are wider. So in other words, there's more spread, interestingly enough. Overall, what I should say is, there's more skewing of return in the Standard & Poor's 500 than there is in the NASDAQ. Now, this number right here, if the median is 12% and the average is 9.9%, that means that there are some heavy losses on the left tail that were not compensated for heavy gains on the right tail of the distribution. The median is above the average. So there were essentially half the returns are above 12%, half are below 12%. But some of those returns below 12% were whoppers that did not have compensators anywhere in the annualized returns on the upside. The average is below the median. So that means that there were more heavy losses than there were symmetric heavy gains. Let me say that again. The median is above the average. So there were some heavy losses that dragged the average down. that did not occur on the upside with similar big gains. So, but if you look at the NASDAQ, yeah, there were some heavy losses, but they really didn't do a lot to pull down the average. Do you see that? The median isn't that much above the average. So this is a more symmetric distribution. There were some losses over the years, annualized return losses, that were kind of notable on the NASDAQ, but they didn't really have that much impact. In other words, there was almost as many gainers as there were big gainers as there were big losers on the NASDAQ. And if you even just look at the data, you can see, look here, you had a year on the NASDAQ, 2000, a negative 40% loss almost. But in 1995, you had a nearly 40% gain. You had a 1980, a 33, almost 34% gain, and then in 2008, a nearly 41% loss. So in other words, there was more balance between gains and losses in the NASDAQ than there was in the Standard & Poor's 500. That's how you interpret that. And I hope you got kind of an idea of this trick with the data queries. These are called queries. Now, if I'm not mistaken, the newest Excel, you go to data and it has a little box on the left side that says new query. And you do it that way. You notice that the way I, in this version of Excel, which is a little older, you go to data and it just says, from the web or whatever. So in the new ones, there's actually a box over here on the left that said, I think it's right on the left side. It says new query. Now, last thing for you. There's something for you. We use the term equity. That's an equity. In other words, it's stock. That's a debt. That's a bond fund. So actually, if you were to put these two together, they are pretty much right on market. And if you put those two together, you would have a portfolio where you could pull back and forth between those two, along with a cash portfolio. And if you're interested, I can show you where to get one that's nothing but treasuries. But these two together are actually a very nice little thing. The problem is they're so darned expensive. I mean, both of those, to buy a round lot of each of those would cost you, $30,000 or something like that. So if your dad and mom are asking you what you want for Christmas, you can't go wrong by telling them this. Okay? You could, but I wouldn't recommend that yet. I mean, I'm going to teach you guys next week. How everyone thinks about buying and selling stocks is the whole market. Actually, there's a whole other side to the market called short selling. And I was thinking I better teach you that before you go out there and become a threat to yourselves and everyone around you by not knowing about that side of the market. Anyway, there you go. I'm not saying you need these, but I'm saying you need these, okay? That's all I have for you today. I thank you.